October, everybody. It's Wednesday, the 8th of October, 2014. I'm Darren Pawley. Today, one admin to rule them all.
You're actually in a really good situation at this point. Your standard users can no longer simply download an executable, drop it on their desktop, and run. That kind of helps with that whole phishing issue. If they want to install software, since they don't have admin rights, they can't write files to program files or Windows, this generates a call to your help desk. Your help desk is now in a position of control to say, does this software have a legitimate business process?
That's Aaron Blaring, an independent penetration tester, who together with buddy Kyle Salus have offered folks here in Washington, D.C. some tips on making their businesses a tougher nut to crack. They discuss dirt cheap changes to access controls, whitelisting, and group policies, to name a few. Antivirus? Yeah, not so much.
Because they do, there is a great feedback loop with them, and they do give us a lot of great advice. So, what is widely believed to be the problem with some of the cyber attacks that we've noticed out there? You'll hear the media and a lot of even cybersecurity professionals say that there are these very sophisticated attacks that are taking place every day, and they're really cool exploits in 0 days. There's really very little that you can do about it. We disagree with this. The real problem here is that we rely way too much on blacklists. Whether it's AV, whether it's IPS signatures, whether it's IP addresses that are from live feeds or domains. So this is the problem. This is a reactive technology, and we feel that, this was okay in the early 2000s, but it's not efficient at this point. What's making this a little bit worse is the proliferation of content delivery networks. So here's this is straight from our proxy logs. This is a month dump of one IP address. And you see it's the same IP address for all these domains. Some of these domains are mainstream domains like Wall Street Journal, MSNBC, and some of them you've never heard of. And they're all sharing the same IP address. This is clearly a problem if you're relying on blacklists. And we've seen a lot of false positives where we come in and, known C2 communication to an IP address. Well, you know what? That was just the Wall Street Journal. Or some other, good site that they were going to. So today's keynote this morning talked about a lot of the attack vectors, and I think they're mostly the same in the last couple of years. Not much has changed. Now, some of the things that came out this year are CryptLocker. I'm sure you've heard of them. The media kind of grabbed this one because it's got this cool aspect of encrypting all the data once it infects the host, and then kind of blackmails the organization into providing the private key so you can get your data back. And they're using really good encryption. So this usually arrives, the set of attack comes through a phishing email or a drive-by download from a compromised site. The second attack vector is actually straight from Mannion's APT1 report. That was referenced this morning. And no one really talks about that as much because of the NSA revelations and internal domestic issues. But that showed that the main attack vector here was a phishing email, a well-thought-out, well-researched social engineering attack that, again, dropped the link to the zip file, and then, the contents were downloaded and extracted from the user's profile. So if you notice something, both of these attacks, which represent a huge portion of the attacks we see out there, the so-called APT attacks, neither one of them really used a zero day. They both relied on executing code from the user's profile, because that's a good place to dump malware, because you're going to assume that you're good admins and you're not giving your users admin credentials. So you don't need admin credentials to run from the user profile. And then in both of these scenarios, in a lot of the cases we're seeing, the users were simply asked to run the malware. So we're doing their job for them, or our users are doing the attacker's job for them. And it's not very sophisticated, it's just highly effective. You can train users all you want, but unless a user is a reverse malware engineer, they're really not going to stop clicking and opening documents. There's a business need for email, there's a business need for the web, and it's hard for them to distinguish the difference between a real well-thought-out social engineering attack or, an actual email. So the idea here of this talk is raising the cost for attackers. And with our approach, we leveraged whitelisting to force attackers to use exploits. And we have a really good patch management program. I know patching has been harped on ever since the beginning of the cybersecurity dumb, but really, you know, you want to patch everything, and you want to have a program in place for this. It's hard to do, but you have to do it. And then we employ some exploit mitigation kits that really help with the crafty O-days that you see, the people that really know what they're doing. And then we also limit admin rights. I just mentioned this. You don't want to give your users admin rights, especially with modern-day operating systems. That's really unnecessary. And we leverage logs from all of our endpoints to detect APT stuff. And we're doing this by not breaking the bank. So we want to limit the costs for our company. And we've deployed AppLocker, which some of you may have heard of and others probably not. It's not, I mean, some main vendors don't even know what AppLocker is. But it's a free tool that Aaron's going to go into later on. And it's a great tool, and it works well if you leverage it. We did network whitelisting with host-based firewalls. That's something we'll cover after AppLocker, and it really, really creates a secure environment for your end hosts. And then we limited admin rights with group policy. Everyone knows group policy if you own Active Directory. And then we rely heavily on EMET. If you don't know what EMET is, it's the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit that Microsoft released. I think we're on version 5 right now. Or you can use more modern-day sandboxes and operating system stuff to look for exploits in memory. And the last one is the advanced log monitoring from all of these kind of tools. And it's got a little star there because it's probably the only one you have to shell out some money for. A SIP is usually pretty expensive, but most of us work for companies that have, you know, really great business models and make good money, and they probably have a budget for SIP. So that's the only one that really, you know, will cost you some money. So you might ask yourself, is whitelisting so great, why doesn't everyone do it? And we're not saying that by any means this is easy. This took a long time to implement. It was in the logging phase before it was in the blocking phase. And there are a lot of steps that you have to take to actually implement it. And the first one is very obvious. You want to get buy-in from the business. You can't, you know, change how the business works and runs software if you don't get, you know, the top executives to sign in on this. The second part is you need to figure out what runs in your environment. You need to inventory every single program, every application that runs, and have that listed somewhere and maybe even hash. This isn't a new concept. I mean, all the top frameworks in security, NIST, ISO, top 35 mitigation strategies from the Australian Defense Institute, and many more reference inventorying software. You need to be doing this. And then finally, understanding the networking protocols that these programs run on. If an application needs to run on a computer, you don't need to open all 65,500 plus ports on both protocols. You need to just understand what it runs on and only allow that. So this is how we've done it in our environment. And finally, you want to train end users to figure out how to whitelist stuff once you've locked down your image. The process here becomes, instead of responding to malware, re-imaging, dealing with compromises, you have a process in place to vet new software that gets deployed to the enterprise and allow it. So Aaron's going to take us through AppLocker. Hopefully, this will be a little bit. We're going to go through a lot of slides, but we do have a slide at the end that has our contact info and more information where you can download some previous presentation. And I think these are going to be given to everyone that attended the conference as well.
The slides will definitely be available. Okay, so application whitelisting has traditionally been thought of as being a very disruptive technology and something that's difficult to manage and overly cumbersome, and therefore the return on investment is too low. We don't believe that's the case. There are more flexible tools out there, and the cost to implement them is basically nothing if you're using what you already own, such as AppLocker. We like AppLocker a lot. It's much more flexible than the traditional 100% hash-based whitelisting approaches that you're with the early type of whitelisting. And most importantly, you probably, as I said, already own it. If you have an enterprise agreement with Microsoft and you're using one of the enterprise SKUs of Windows, AppLocker is available to you free of charge. If you're in a Windows domain, you manage it through the same GPOs that you manage the rest of your policies. So again, the cost to deploy this is really just a matter of taking the time to figure out what you need to do, put it in place, and properly test it. Now, if you have a home edition of Windows and you wanted to do something similar, you don't actually get the same AppLocker interface, so you can't just dive right into group policy and manage it, but under the covers, what's kind of interesting is parental controls. which is available on most modern SKUs of Windows, is using AppLocker underneath the covers. If you wanted to do this at home, you can simply set up an administrator account, which will be your parent account, and then your standard user accounts are your child accounts, and you can then dictate exactly what the child accounts can use. So you can even do this at home if you like. My wife loves it. So if you've never taken a look at AppLocker, I'm going to give you a pretty quick crash course on what it can do, how it works, and show you some ways that we can leverage it. AppLocker has controls and policies that monitor and control executables, MSIs for installers, scripts that run through the native Windows scripting host, such as Visual Basic, Batch, PowerShell, and finally DLLs. And DLLs, by default, is not on. You have to take a couple of extra steps to enable it, but it is really, really powerful once it's up and running. Now, some of the gotchas with it are it's not going to do anything about your hosted scripting languages, such as macros within Office, or even ActiveX controls that are running within Office. That's beyond the context of what we have time to get into here, but there are additional GPOs you can enable to lock that down and to cover some of those bases. So when you start creating your rules, you have three basic rule types. Publisher, which is the most flexible. As long as your software maker has signed their code, you can create a rule based on their name and say anything from company A is good, I'm going to allow it. You can do path-based rules. Anything that's in a specific directory is allowed to run. Or hash. That's your classic SHA-256 hash. If it matches it, you can allow it. If not, it doesn't run. So some guidelines for these. Path rules are only acceptable if end users cannot write to that location. Otherwise, that's an obvious way around your AppLocker deployment. So in those locations where users can write, that's where you need to leverage publisher rules, or if it's not signed, hash rules. And that's going to be the one that requires the most maintenance. Microsoft is a wizard that's part of the group policy, which you can just click through and it'll automatically create all these rules for you. But you have to be careful with that. What it tries to do is coalesce all of the rules, and for publisher rules especially, this can be dangerous. You may not want to allow everything that's signed by Microsoft, and I'll give some very specific examples of that later in the presentation. So, getting started, there's two main approaches that you can consider. One, which if you read, there's a white paper from Microsoft on deploying AppLocker. They recommend the gold image approach. It's definitely the 100% best way to do it. You take your standard image, run the wizard against it. Anything that's not part of your default build will no longer be allowed. This is great for static workstations, things like your point-of-sale terminals, kiosks, things that aren't very dynamic. However, your typical end-user workstation, it's not such a great fit. And this is where people start saying this is going to be too unwieldy to use. They recommend in their paper, again, to never use what is out-of-the-box functionality to create what are called default rules. Default rules basically allow anything that is in the program files directory, the Windows directory, to be run, or an administrator to run. And the reason why they recommend against this is it kind of comes back to that whole admin issue. If your end users are admins, this gives them a quick end run around the system. This is what it looks like when you're actually editing a group policy for AppLocker. It's a pretty simple interface. Here I've just highlighted the ability to create those default rules. I recommend actually using the default rules for most organizations. If you're not doing that kind of lockdown kiosk, the added flexibility, while it is slightly less secure, you know, to paraphrase Voltaire, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Let's do something that at least pushes back and makes the attacks more difficult for our attackers. So in order to make this work, you have to be able to restrict who is an admin within your organization. Again, group policy to the rescue. And I'll show how we can do that in a minute. But what you need to make sure is none of your end users will ever log in as an admin. And in fact, that includes your IT department. Everyone who is an administrator in your organization should have a separate admin account that they use for escalation only at the time that they need to perform admin activities. Another way you can help lock things down is as part of your imaging process. Create a unique password for every single local administrator. This is that built-in admin account or the break-of-glass account that you have on your laptop. So when it's out of the network, if you need to tell someone to do something over the phone, they can use that. Since it's a unique password, if you have to divulge that, you haven't given away the keys to your kingdom. This also helps prevent some lateral movement. And here's what a typical group policy preference that could be used to lock this down looks like. Every 90 minutes, which is the default for a group policy refresh, it's going to take your admin group, it's going to purge all the members, all the users, all the groups that are in it, then it's going to rebuild it. And in this case, I'm showing an example of the local admin, which is our account that is going to be a break of the Glass account, the built-in administrator account, which should be disabled by default, and then a group that is responsible for managing the local workstations. Notice something that's absent from this. I don't put the domain administrators in there. No domain administrator account should ever log into an endpoint, period. So if you've done all this, you're actually in a really good situation at this point. Your standard users can no longer simply download an executable, drop it on their desktop, and run. That kind of helps with that whole phishing issue. If they want to install software, since they don't have admin rights, they can't write files to program files or Windows, this generates a call to your help desk. Your help desk is now in a position of control to say, does this software have a legitimate business process, and are we going to allow this on our systems and escalate it through the proper channels? Also, using the default rules, since we are allowing program files in Windows by default, you don't have to do a constant upkeep. And if you're deploying new programs through whatever your deployment technology is, whether it be SCCM or any of these other big system management products, when they get written there, they're allowed. Most importantly, if we've done this, we've now raised the bar for our attackers significantly. As I said, they can't just ask you to run an executable. Now they're going to need to use some sort of exploitation in order to gain remote code execution on your system. Once they have exploited, if they are successful with that, we've also limited their options for persistence. If they wanted to drop some sort of a file, which, again, they like to use AppData because they have right access to it, that file's not going to be able to run because AppLocker's going to block it in the future. So beyond the first exploitation, they now have to escalate privilege as well. Every time we make them work, that's a chance to detect their activity. So what does it look like in action? Well, here's an example of file that was perhaps sent to us. You know, maybe one of your executives received it. It appears to be from a company that they work with frequently that says, here's a link to the latest invoice. Please download it and process it accordingly. They downloaded it to their desktop. This looks like a standard PDF. However, if you look at the properties of it, this is definitely not a PDF. Rather, it's an executable file. And in your standard breach scenario, this would get run. They would then start establishing persistence, moving around the network, taking whatever they want to plunder. And, you know, later when the breach notification finally comes up, there would be some sort of a statistic quoted saying 0 out of 47 antivirus engines on VirusTotal were able to detect this file because it was custom made for that organization. However, if they had AppLocker in place, when they double-click on it, this is what they're presented with. A prompt that says, this doesn't run. And you've effectively mitigated that threat, forcing them to try a different avenue. So when you want to roll this out, it does have the possibility of being disruptive. This isn't something that you want to just casually decide, okay, this sounds great. When I go back to my office, I'm going to put an AppLocker in place and just see what happens. That may be a career-limiting move. Instead, you want to test thoroughly. And I mean, take a lot of time testing. Small groups, you can leverage your OU structure to target smaller test groups, and additionally, AppLocker has the function where it can be pushed out in audit-only mode, where it will warn you as though if it would have blocked something, it puts a log. Even if you have no intention of actually ever going to enforce mode, I highly recommend everyone turn on AppLocker in audit mode. Later on in the presentation, I'll talk about some ways that you can leverage the logs that it creates. Whether you're enforced or not, at least get the data. Some gotchas. AppLocker cannot control anything that's run by the system process. So in a typical lateral movement scenario using PSExec, the PSExec service that gets spawned on the workstation they're moving toward will run under the system account. That's not going to be blocked. However, you can use it to block the PSExec executable in the first place, so that is one option there. Something else to notice is there are a lot of legitimate applications that will run out of the user profile. You need to be proactive to whitelist those things that have a business process. At the last minute, before your most senior executives are about to sign into a conference, you do not want to be scrambling to whitelist whatever web meeting software they're about to use. So proactively go to those tester meeting links, make sure that it's going to run, and make sure that's allowed. If you are using path rules, make sure that they have strong ACLs so that people can't write to a subfolder of it. Go through the process of doing that ACL audit that your attacker is likely going to do. And lastly, you may want to create some exceptions for the default rules. There are a lot of tools built into Windows that your attackers would love to use against you that your users have no use for. We're going to cover some of those later on in the presentation, so I promise I'll come back to that. Some additional uses for it. We can block things that just doesn't have a business use in our environment but adds to our attack surface. Shockwave, for example. Tons of vulnerabilities come up in it all the time. Chances are you don't need it for a business. Don't allow it to be installed on your workstations. It's one less program that you have to manage. Other scripting languages, such as Perl, Python, Auto, you can block these with AppLocker. These are things that would never be blocked by an AV system, but you can block them with AppLocker. Virtualization platforms. If someone brings a virtual machine in on your standard issue desktop, that could be a way that they're getting around your AD21X implementation. So you might not want to allow that. If you do have an outbreak and you want to quickly block a malicious executable, this might be a good option to avoid tipping your hand to your adversary. If you send your executable off to your AV vendor, they're going to create a signature. They have access to VirusTotal. They'll see that it's now being detected. If you don't want to tip your hand, you can do this as a targeted blacklist. And finally, you can use it to augment your patch management system. Here's an example of a publisher rule within AppLocker that's being used to block any version of Java except for the most recent version. So if you are rolling out that new version and you know that your users are starting to face exploits against an older version of Java, even though Java wouldn't be blocked by AV, we can block that insecure version of Java from running in our environment, giving us some additional protection. I'm going to hand it over to Kyle now, and he's going to talk about some ways to augment this using network whitelisting.
Thanks, Aaron. So let's say someone finds a way around AppLocker. Everyone talks about defense in depth. So we went a step further here and decided to do some network whitelisting, I guess is what we ended up calling it, with host-based firewalls. So for the most part, nowadays, your AV client or license will probably include a firewall, host-based firewall. Most of the big vendors just give it away. If they don't, the increase to get the firewall is not much at all. It's a couple bucks. So what we're saying, what I want you to take out of the network whitelisting part is enable the firewalls within your domain, on your network. Everyone just enables a host-based firewall for the remote users or when users connect to Starbucks or whatever, but enable the firewall rule, enable firewall, host-based firewalls internally, and then create granular rules to control what applications need to talk to what servers. This can also be very disruptive. You might want to start with a logging mode. That's a lot easier to do than the firewall because you can just set it to allow and then log, just like most firewall rules work here. And the idea here is you want to create application rules to only allow those applications and those ports to talk to the servers internally that they need. Again, you don't need to allow everything on every port for every application. The cool thing about host-based firewalls is that they are closest to the endpoint. They even surpass next-gen firewalls in terms of accuracy. You install this on the host, it tells you exactly what application is making the request on what port. A next-gen firewall has to crack open a packet on the wire and take a guess based on a signature and algorithm to tell you if that's Google Chat or if that's a WebEx meeting, what have you. And then you want to explicitly deny all other traffic and log it. I mean, for the firewall admins in here, that's a common rule. I mean, it makes sense to have that. So the idea behind a host-based firewall within your domain with very granular rules is that you want to enforce the concept of least privilege on the network level. Everyone talks about least privilege from a user access, user account level. Guess what? Start thinking about it from a network and application level. We don't need to open everything for all the applications. I mean, we've harped on this. I've harped on it. But it might be a little bit daunting to think about enabling a firewall on every single host, sometimes thousands of hosts for every single, and have those rules centrally managed. So if you need a good platform to do this, a lot of the major AV vendors give you a central management server that is easy to use, really. And then turn on logging for all the rules. This is a lot of traffic. This is a lot of data. Every rule, every connection from every host being logged. We'll talk about monitoring and what you can do with that information, but there are some things you have to take into consideration before you turn this on. And then you want to build rules on the server side. So don't leave your servers wide open because they're servers. I mean, that's an antiquated model. Servers only perform very, very specific functions. You don't need to be listening on all the ports if you're a server. So this is a sample. This is an oversimplified rule. Our rule set is a lot bigger than this, and yours will be as well. But rule one is illustrating the legitimate application traffic that talks to your local servers. Figure out what those are. Chances are, if you enable AppLocker, you have a pretty good idea of what those are. You can either start with this or start with AppLocker to figure out what applications you have running in your environment. It took us a really long time to get that big picture. So, you know, you want to turn on logging and dump logs and filter to get an idea of what runs in your environment. The second rule talks about PowerShell and FTP and applications like it. So you have legitimate uses for PowerShell as admins, right, as IT. It's a powerful tool. There's a reason it exists. Microsoft and admins love it. But you know what? Not everyone needs to run it, and it doesn't need to run or connect to every single server in your environment. So rule number two is allowing it to run where it needs to. Rule number three deals with just disallowing it where it doesn't need to. And obviously, you want to order your rules here, just like any firewall top-down. And you can add rules like PSExec and the Windows equivalent, the Unix equivalent of PSExec, which is WinExec here. And this is to augment what AppLocker can do. So if you remember, Aaron mentioned that PSExec can't be stopped or prevented from executing remotely from via AppLocker because it runs a system. Guess what? You can stop the service name or the hash from running via host-based firewall. Host-based firewalls are extremely flexible. You can build rules on almost anything you can imagine in terms of the username, the IP address, the time, the application name, etc. Rule number four deals with the specific applications that you found out are legitimate and the programs that need to run and connect to the internet. You allow AD443, whatever needs to be open outbound, for those applications. And then you put a deny all rule and you lock. This is something that a lot of people don't do because we've had a lot of issues with logging and getting this tuned with the vendors in terms of the support. From a support perspective, we thought, you know, other people might have done this and, you know, paved the way for us to kind of just turn it on, but it doesn't seem like it. So this is an example of what denying PowerShell and allowing it at the same time looks like. The top line shows an internal connection to a web server that's allowed based on your rule set, and the second line shows you the PowerShell trying to connect outside to the internet, trying to pull a shellcode's PowerShell script. That's denied. That's how effective host-based firewall rules can be. It can be very granular if you order them in the right way. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about monitoring. So you've got all this data coming in from AppLocker, presumably right now, logs from AppLocker. By the way, AppLocker will dump all the application logs that are allowed to run and prevent it from running into the security event log. It's a little bit deeper in there, but it does get dumped in there. Then you have all these firewall logs coming in from thousands of clients for every connection made. You can do a lot with this information, but it can get overwhelming quickly. That's why you want to make sure you're only running the things that you need to run and nothing else. You don't want iTunes or Shockwave running on a business computer if it doesn't need to be there, and it creates noise. So the first thing we did was we defined a retention policy. There are disk considerations, there are storage considerations, legal considerations with what logs you can keep. I think there was a talk about that earlier. In the management track. So figure out what those considerations and those limitations are and build accordingly. The idea here is once you have that infrastructure set up, you can build some pretty advanced tools to detect the lateral movement of those advanced persistent attackers. We're not saying that AppLocker or the host-based firewall is going to completely eliminate all the threats. They're going to raise the bar for your attackers. But at the same time, when they do, if you do get breached, you do have some recourse here with that. With the monitoring and logging piece. So when you log, the first bullet is the standard stuff. Firewalls, IPS, IDS, Windows, and Netlogs. Sure, do all that. Make sure it's parsed. It's coming in. The really neat stuff comes in when you start pulling client and Netlogs. So AppLocker logs. There are event IDs associated with an application being prevented from running and an application being allowed to run. If you tune your environment properly and you're doing whitelisting, you shouldn't have a lot of prevented from running. So whatever application, you can pull those easily and write correlation rules with applications that were denied to run, like that Adobe fake EX or fake Adobe document. The third bullet really mentions something. I know there's a talk about flow data, but you know, we discovered that having flow data really helps you when you don't have either a system that can actually send logs to a SIM, or when you have rogue machines on your network. So if you don't explicitly point something to a SIM or to a syslog facility, you're not getting logs from it. But the flow collector will collect those logs,
And if you augment that with, like, you know, partial packet capture data, and put it, let's say, in the DMZ, you could capture all the requests and attacks that come against your DMZ server, and you can look at the payload and say, all right, this guy tried to run PHP against my IIS server. I don't care. Here's the payload. You know, move on. So I'm sure there's a lot more interesting stuff that we can learn from the talk on flows. Client firewall logs. They provide an immense amount of data. I'll show you a slide here that has, like, a sample payload. But again, we mentioned the application making the connection with deadly accuracy, the domain and the user, and the local and remote IP. When you get the domain that was requested for the connection, that's like having DNS, because it is logging every single connection to every single domain. And what we realize is, sadly, most of us really don't do this level of logging, because it is difficult, but it is doable. The reason we say this is, so we get this graph. I'll tell you a little story behind how you know this graph bothered us for months at a time. But this is our AV central management server. This is where all the logs go. And it's pointed to our SIM. And this is a graph from our SIM showing those logs coming in. And we're seeing it come in at 15-minute intervals, even though the server is configured to send logs continuously or every 30 seconds. So we open a case with this major AV vendor, like, look, what's going on here? Do a bunch of packet captures, you know, low-level debugging. And finally, they come back with this. This is their official response, basically saying they had no idea how logging worked, because not a lot of people have tried doing this. And thank you for pointing that out. So, you know, we know that people aren't doing this. We actually asked our SIM vendor, you know, how many people are trying to collect logs? This is a major SIM vendor from M clients, you know, at the verbose level that we're talking about. And they said, I can count them on one hand. So it can be done. We're doing it right now. Some of the things that you can do to get creative with the firewall rules that you built, you can build alerts once you have them coming in to your SIM. You can build alerts on things like PowerShell.exe or Notepad. Notepad's the first thing Metasploit will migrate into once it pops shell on a machine. You know, PowerShell doesn't need to run. None of your users, unless they're IT administrators, know what PowerShell is. They don't need to run it. And if it does run, you can alert on them. You can also alert on anything running from the user profile that wasn't whitelisted in the firewall rule set. We'll show you some examples of how we've caught some interesting stuff with that. And as I said, firewall rules can get very granular on the host level. You can create firewall rules based on hash, time of use, the profile. You can create different profiles based on AD groups, marketing, HR, etc. And you can even do it based on the NIC level, where you connect via wireless, or you connect via Ethernet. So here's a sample log of what a host-based firewall connection looks like. The stuff highlighted in red is, I think, the cool stuff. You've got the domain that was requested. This is from every client in your domain to every single web request, pretty much. The application, in this case, is Internet Explorer, and then the name of the rule. Obviously, there's other meaningful information that you can take out of this and do some pretty interesting correlation. Couple that with proxy and firewall logs and IPS alerts and AV triggers, and then you have some pretty powerful stuff. So sample the false positive. So this is where you're going to see when you do this in your environment. We get an alert for some traffic that went out to a server from PowerShell. You're like, all right, well, what's going on here? Your users aren't supposed to go on PowerShell. And it turned out, once we did some investigation, it was an IT administrator. And they're like, all right, you're connecting to a new server that wasn't part of our rule set. Let's add that server to the rule set and move on. That was expected, that was something that we had known that that server was supposed to be able to, receive PowerShell communication. So this is a sample of a true positive. TeamViewer.exe, it's some remote access / file sharing application. We got alert that it got blocked running from an app data. This is from the firewall rules. Over 443, you're like, all right, what's going on here? Again, happened to be an admin. And you'll see there's some commonalities here. And he was a new user to the firm. He's an IT administrator. And he was trying to circumvent AppLocker by trying to install this application. And the firewall is completely independent of AppLocker, and it's completely independent of your admin credentials. It's locked down with a different password. So you can't disable the firewall and modify the rules. So we got an alert that this admin was trying to install TeamViewer. Some of the gotchas with firewalls. There is a lot of data. We've said that a couple of times, but you need to find a way to normalize logs from users that are off-site. You have road warriors, salespeople that are gone for 2 years, 2 years, 2 weeks at a time, and they come back with all these logs that are they're chewed up. guess what? You send that to your SIM. That is a lot of that's a lot of logs. And if you know anything about SIMs, they use the term PPS. That's how they charge you for the SIM, events per second. And those licenses are really expensive. So if every time a user comes back, they're trying to dump a ton of logs to your SIM, that's going to cost you. So you're trying to figure out how to normalize logs and you know send them to the SIM. Other things we noticed, service discovery, NetBIOS, stuff like that, turn off the logging on those rules because the SIM is so chatty that the SIM will just keep alerting on those as being like port scans. Just a note there. And then finally, you mentioned blocking the firewall interface. If your machine gets owned, you don't want to just give them the ability to disable AV. AV vendors are familiar with these tactics. They know that the first thing someone does when they compromise a machine is they go after AV because they want to download their tools and not have AV bother them. So lock down AV. Don't allow end users to add firewall policies, modify it, disable it. Completely different password. Don't even give it to some of your admins so they don't circumvent it. I'm going to let Aaron finish up here.
Thanks. So we talked about bringing in some of the application execution logs and some of the ways that are powerful for using this for monitoring to really try and detect what's going on in your network. Now, if you look at like the NSA guide, it recommends capturing all the AppLocker block logs. That's great. You know that something got blocked. But I think it's actually far more interesting to log what did get allowed. Because that's where you can actually see what is happening potentially in a post-exploitation or during a real compromise. The advanced attackers, they're generally going to start off using some sort of malicious payload to get their first initial foothold onto your network. But as soon as they're in there, their goal is going to be to stop using any custom payload they can and start running in by using your common admin tools, the things that are built into your Windows environment. And so what we want to do is baseline what is the normal usage of these applications. Do people in our environment actually use them for legitimate purposes? And if not, when it's something outside of that baseline, alert on it. The way that I like to do this is to create tuples. If you're just using AppLocker, it's going to feed to you a log that says the name of the application that was run and who ran it, who ran it. That can be enough right there, just because if you see a non-admin running a specific application, you can alert on that. Something that's even more powerful that just came out recently, if you haven't taken a look at Sysmon from Microsoft SysInternals, you absolutely must. This thing is awesome. It creates a log that will show you the image that was run, the parent image that launched that image, as well as the full command line, and putting that into a log, as well as the user who executed it. Take that as a tuple and bring that into your SIM, and now you can really do some awesome correlation and tuning of these false positive events. So here are some of the tools that I alluded to earlier, some of the things that are possibly normal for an admin to run, but not so normal for your end users. These are things that you might want to consider, first of all, putting in your AppLocker not just the monitoring, but the exception rule list to your default rules, so that your regular end users are not allowed to run these. And then further, once you've started baselining and figuring out who does run these, maybe you want to block them altogether. PowerShell and WMIC are unfortunately at the bottom. I probably should have put those up at the top. Immediately after this talk, there's going to be one on WMI and one on PowerShell. Attackers are noticing how useful these are, and they're going to start using them. Your end users have no use for either of these. So don't allow your end users to use it, and if you see one of those end users trying to use it, you need to alert on it. And now here are some other built-in processes that, in our experience after we started monitoring, we just didn't see these run a single time. A lot of these are tools that have been deprecated by Microsoft, but they're still in the operating system. Attackers love them because they can run them from the command line, and they can get your system to do things to their bidding. We've seen app.exe and psexec in almost every single breach report. App was deprecated by Microsoft years ago in favor of schedule tests. PsExec, there's better ways to manage your systems proactively. If you don't need these in your environments, block them and take that tool away from your attackers. So, again, looking at what it looks like when you start monitoring, here's a sample of a false positive. In our environment, when we first started monitoring these processes, I started getting a lot of alerts saying sc.exe was launched by services.exe, run in the context of system. After a lot of investigation, we figured out, okay, this is normal. This is just part of a regular process that we have installed as part of our software. This is okay. We tune the SIM to get that out of the alert set. Now that's allowed, but we can still monitor for when SC gets called. And here's an example of the flip side of that. During a recent pen test, one of the things we like to do is we give our pen testers a laptop with a domain user account and say, have at it, what can you do to this? They took it away, banged on it for a while, brought it back, plugged it into our network. As soon as it got on the network, we immediately got an alert that said sc.exe was called from command.exe under the context of a standard user account. This is highly unusual. So we immediately went and looked at all the rest of the logs, and we would see in the AppLocker logs all the times they tried to run their malware and that got blocked. And had this been a regular user or a normal event, we probably would have yanked the machine and done more analysis on it. Since it was our pen testers, we knew it was them, we decided to let them continue to be frustrated for a couple of days before we told them what was going on. So that's how it can actually be used to detect true malicious activity. So what we're really getting at here is taking a more proactive approach to forensics. You know, take some time. If you look at any of the major breach reports, you'll see the tools that are being used by the attackers once they're on the network, how they're moving around. And what we want to do is, instead of waiting till the breach happens and having to call in a company to do that analysis at what is, let's be honest, a very expensive hourly rate, we want to capture those logs ahead of time. You know, anything that is going to help you build the picture of exactly what happened, get those logs, get them off of the systems where they can't be cleaned off, they can't cover their tracks. And now you have a log. If we were collecting everything from applications that were executed and firewall logs, you know everything that got run, every system that they talked to, when it happened, and you can do that forensic analysis just by running some queries in your SIM. So, in conclusion, we firmly believe that as defenders, we all need to start doing more to push back on our attackers. It's entirely too easy for them to simply ask someone to run an executable. You know, if we did a survey of this room and said, who in this room has successfully created a payload that evaded AV, I would expect that almost everyone in the room could raise their hand. Who in this room can run Metasploits, use a known exploit to pop shell on clocks? Probably everyone in the room. Who in this room has taken the time to write custom shellcode, to fuzz an application, to create their own ODAC against a modern app that can get around and it? Suddenly, the group of attackers becomes a lot smaller. And we're no longer having to respond to those day-to-day malware threats, but we're able to focus in and monitor for that truly advanced adversary and see when they are going to start trying to probe their way into our systems. And that is really, really powerful. So, at this time, we'd like to open things up to answer some questions. One other thing I forgot to mention that I'll mention here, we do have some materials that are available on SourceForge. If you want to try out some of the things I mentioned from AppLocker GPOs, I have GPOs up there that you can take, import, and start testing that do all of the things I mentioned. They have exceptions for some of those common programs. They have exceptions for examples of the vulnerable programs that can be blocked. So give it a try. Put it in and start auditing. So questions are going to come up?
How large is your organization, and is there some general ratio of the time cost for implementing whitelisting based on the number of systems employees? We actually, there's a paper that we wrote for IEEE, I don't think it's out yet, that deals with this question, but it depends on how big. We have, 850 machines?
Yep.
So not big, not tiny. It took us how many months to get AppLocker in enforcement?
As we rolled it out, we started with just doing executables, MSIs, and scripts first. That took about 3 months to get that in, and then another 3 months to get DLL enforcement in. As a whole, the way to look at it is you're trading the reaction for the proactive piece. You're no longer responding to a compromised host and cleaning it up. You're proactively spending the time to whitelist, and at the same time, you've vastly reduced your risk.
So is there a tie? They just changed that. If PSExec can't be blocked in AppLocker because it runs the system, does this mean any executable that injects itself into system processes can bypass AppLocker?
I would say potentially yes. AppLocker bypasses, they're still interesting. I haven't read too many of them that actually get around AppLocker itself. But yes, if you were able to inject into a process running a system, that would be a way of shortcutting AppLocker. However, the processes that are running on as system tend to be some of the more important processes. And again, that's a chance to, it may create instability on the system as part of the exploit. You can potentially detect that. And it also just still, we're raising the bar. We're not going to say that AppLocker is perfect, but it makes it harder on our adversaries.
Here's one about Bit9. We have Bit9 that are afraid of blocking because of inconsistent signing with software publishers. What's your recommendation? I mean, there are, with AppLocker, there are three ways that you can write this. Sign software, sign code, which is what you're doing with Bit9. You can do it by hash, which is more work because you have to individually allow all the files that you want to hash to run. Or you can do it by path. Obviously, with path, you have to have ACL directories properly so then your admins can only write to them. So look at, I don't know if Bit9 supports, you know, whitelisting by hash or path even.
I think it does all of the above. And I think really the answer is you need to audit your software makers. Are they properly signing their stuff? And when they aren't, push back on them. You are their customer. On that SourceForge website, for example, I've got a script that will go through a directory and audit all the executables in that directory and say which ones are signed and which ones aren't. And you will have to handhold your software vendors in some cases. We actually convinced a major networking manufacturer to start signing all the VPN software based on us going back and forth, and it took a long time. The good news is we're both very stubborn, and so we just dogged at them for about 6 months, and then they started signing all of the code.
Last one's interesting.
How can AppLocker be implemented without creating gridlock for new software requests? So part of that comes back to using default rules. You don't need to create a rule if it's going to be loaded into the Windows directory or program files. So if a user calls, say, the help desk on a weekend and there's an emergency, if it's a regular, well-coded program that doesn't dump files all over the hard drive but does it in the right place and puts it in program files, that can be installed, and your help desk should be able to walk them through that without bugging you Saturday night, whatever, to write an AppLocker log. And then that's one of the reasons why we say, you know, at least try the default rules.
I think these are all the remaining questions are about how AppLocker really works. So the SCCM question, is there a tie-in with SCCM is a question to make it work with AppLocker. So AppLocker is a GPO. It's an Active Directory GPO that you push out. You don't really need SCCM. And it gets deployed like a GPO, gets renewed every 90 minutes unless you do a GP update force for a new rule. So that's how you control and manage AppLocker. For the question that asked it, how do you prevent a user with valid credentials from messing around with AppLocker? I mean, that's all the ACL thing that Aaron touched on. Your users shouldn't be able to have any administrative rights. Your admins, I mean, if you're doing your admin segmentation properly, not all your admins are the main admins, so they don't have access to the AppLocker GPO. They don't need access to it. You know, they follow the same process that your users do to allow an application to run.
You can also audit your AppLocker group policy updates. Every time a group policy gets updated in Active Directory, a log is written. Audit those logs. If they don't correspond with a ticket from your help desk system or a change control, that's an event of interest that you need to start investigating. And finally, all these logs seem onerous. How do you make the flood manageable? You need to be more precise about what you're collecting. Don't just collect every single log from the security log on a system. Don't collect every single, even with AppLocker logs, you may not want to collect all the DLL logs. One of the ways that we got around it to make it a manageable thing, AppLocker, if you do DLL logs, it's going to log, you know, close to 30 megs of logs in a day. That's logs, very small little entries. So if you filter that down and you pull in only the blocks for any category, and don't do the DLL allows, that's one way to cut down the flood. You're still seeing the executables that were lodged, which may be not as useful because you'll see like, you know, service host or something like that. You won't know exactly what DLL was launched. But this is better than nothing. Again, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Put something in and start looking at it. So thank you, and I hope you enjoyed it. Enjoy the conference.